Well, today we're going to be starting with Exodus chapter 20, verse 8. So where we left off last time, the Lord had visited Mount Sinai, and it was quite a visit. Smoke, fire, quakes, and in the midst of all that, the people are seeing all that, and Moses speaks, and God's response to Moses is in the form of thunder. And out of that, God calls Moses to the top of the mountain. And so Moses goes to the top of the mountain. He gets there and God says, okay, now go back down and tell the people not to cross the boundary. In 2 weeks ago, they set a boundary and God said, don't let anybody cross that, because if they do, it's a death penalty for them. So he says, go down and tell them, and tell the priests to consecrate themselves before coming near the mountain. So as they approach the boundary, they need to be consecrated. Moses, I think I would say, argues. It's not strong language on Moses' part, but he says, they already know. We already told them. You told me to tell them, I told them. God's answer is, go down again and tell them not to cross the boundary. I think Moses sometimes has a little trouble understanding that God didn't bring it up as a discussion. God knows what is what, completely, thoroughly, 100%, past, present, and future. So it's best to just do what you're told. But he says, go down, tell them, and then come up again with Aaron. So Moses goes down, and when he goes down, he is interacting there with the people. And it's a little bit ambiguous, but it's obvious that as Moses gives the instructions, God begins to speak to Moses. And Moses is there, we'll see later on, that he is close enough to the people that he interacts with both the people and God. So where's he at on the mountain? I'm not sure I could tell you, but both are involved in the conversation. And it's going to be the giving of the Ten Commandments. This is verse 20 that we covered last time, or chapter 20. He gives them what we would call the Ten Commandments. He starts out by saying, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of slavery, and he brought you to myself on eagle's wings. And so God establishes who he is and the basis for what he's going to tell them. And he gives them then the commands. And we got the first command, that you'll have no other gods before me. And a better reading of that might be, no other gods against me. That could be a part of that word very easily, just without any kind of logic being applied. But if you have another god before God, that's against God, right? So that's pretty obvious. The second command, you're not going to make any idols. No, the best word, the best translation there is what the King James did for years, no graven images. You're not to make an image to worship, whether that image would have represented God himself or some other God. Don't do that, God says. And he says, why? He says, I'm a jealous God. He wants complete, undivided worship and attention and devotion and even consecration toward him. And so he said that to do so would be idolatry, And it would affect down to the third and fourth generation. The sin of idolatry will have an impact on the people and their lineage. And then we finished up with a third command, which said, don't take the name of the Lord in vain. We think of swearing and cursing, but it would include false teaching. It's a very broad application. The basics of it is giving improper credit for the things God does to a something else, or denying giving God credit for the things that he actually does. And that's kind of subtle sometimes, and I don't want to go too far with this because I think I could, but this idea of Mother Nature is one of those where we say, well, that's just nature. Well, who made nature? A lot of times, a lot of times, the correct understanding of every application I can think of where we just say, well, that's the forces of nature at work, would be to say, that's just the way God made it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Because nature comes out of how God created the world. It is natural. It is the way it goes. It's what happens. And of course, one big part of nature today is, I'm going through it trying to get things settled up in my dad's estate and all the stuff he collected for years, is decay. And decay came about because of our sin. And God even talks about storing up things where they don't rust and thieves don't break in and steal, because that's the nature of things. But that corruption came with our own sin. And we certainly see that in the plant world. If you try to keep a yard or keep a farm or keep anything else, sin came in and thorns grew. And many other kinds of weeds along with that. And so in that third commandment, don't take the Lord's name in vain, God says, I'm not going to leave that unpunished. So that's a big deal. And of course, all of the commandments are a big deal. I don't want to trivialize anything by stressing that. But God pointed out in this one, their punishment will occur. And so we've got this broad list of things that certainly does include cursing and oath-taking and visible disrespect and so on of God and false teaching. And probably one of the most famous ones is Nietzsche said many years ago, God is dead. Well, I will tell him, no, you're wrong. He is not dead. So that brings us to verse 8 in Exodus 20. So I'm going to read verses 8 through 17. And this is what God is still speaking verbally. These are not the stone commandments yet. That's going to come later. He's speaking to Moses where the people can hear. And we'll see that, I think, before we get done today. Remember the Sabbath day, verse 8, to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male or your female servant or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And so we find here's the rest of the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue as it's sometimes called. And we're down to the fourth one. And the fourth one, I think, is a wonderful commandment. There's a lot of teaching in there. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. God gives his reason why. Why was the Sabbath day established for the Jewish nation by God? He tells us right here. Why?
He made the world in 6 days.
He made the world in 6 days.
He rested on the Sabbath.
And he rested on the Sabbath. In that rest, he himself consecrated that day as a special day to worship him and to remember that day of rest. And he says to keep it what?
Holy.
How do you do that? What was he asking these people to do? Well, he lays out some things right there. Your focus will not be on your life work. Now, Jesus is going to come along later and say, now, well, if your ox goes in the ditch, you're going to get him out of the ditch. So it's not the emergency things necessarily, but you're not going to work. You're going to organize your life so the things that need to be done in this 7-day period get done on the 6 days. And the seventh day, then, you are going to rest. You're not going to work. Does it stop there? No. What else does it say?
None of your sons, daughters, servants, nobody will work, period.
Yeah, and you got the bulk of them there. I'm pleased that it says this, nor your sojourners. You got a traveler come stays with you, doesn't have to be Jewish. If you're going to stay under my roof, you're not going to work on the Sabbath. You're not going to travel. You're not going to do any of those life tasks that could have been done in the 6 days. And you need to figure out how to get them done in the 6 days. You don't just leave something undone, make it an excuse. You're going to not work. You're not going to be involved in activities. This is a day of rest. And the idea of that day of rest is to mimic God's day of rest. And how could you do this without stopping to remember what God did on 6 days? That's very significant. God is reinforcing his role in establishing this world. When you follow God's direction here and limit your working activities to 6 days so you can rest on the seventh, like God did when he created, you have just done a number of things that are important to who you are, to your faith, to your testimony, to your understanding as a people, where you fit into the scheme of things as God created them. God owns this creation. It was his as he created it, and it is his today. And so these people, remember, he said he's going to establish them as they follow his commands to be what?
His followers.
His possession.
His people.
And priests. They're going to be a nation of priests. Their function is to be proclaiming the message of God to the world around them. Foundational to that message, and it's foundational yet today, is who is God? And what level of dominion does he have over this world? And by celebrating the Sabbath and other laws that we're going to find go down to great detail before we're done, I'm not quite sure how I'm going to present that myriad of laws. That I'm not disrespecting them, I'm just saying, that's a lot of detail, but we'll figure it out. God is creating a situation of a people that stand out as different from the rest of the world. And so, as they celebrate the Sabbath, they are remembering and affirming God is creator. And that he rules the world. And as ruler of the world, we're obligated to follow his leadership or his direction for us. And so this is foundational to their identity as a people and as a nation. Think of the challenges we have today in dealing with people that don't want to accept who God is, that he is creator, that he establishes right and wrong, that he establishes how we ought to live, and even establishes how we resolve our rebellion. And right here, they've got a tool that as they do this as a nation is going to set them apart. There may be others that do similar things, I don't know, but this is going to be clear that we're doing it because we know who God is. And we know what he did, and we know his position. And so if you're a guest in my house, I'm going to shove my religion down your throat. Well, that's not exactly the way to say it, but that's the way it would be received today. In my house, here are things that we do. Glad to have you. Join with us in doing them, or find somewhere else to stay. Because this is who we are, and this is what we do. And for the Jews, the Sabbath was foundational to their behaviors as priests of God. Questions, comments, thoughts? Yes, sir.
I wonder how they established if they had a guest, if their fabric was made out of more than one material.
Well, I don't know, and that's really not even in here at this point.
But the law of Jews prohibits wearing clothes made of two fabrics.
I'm not familiar with that, so I can't really respond to that. And as far as that being a part of the Sabbath, I mean, I'm really talking about the Sabbath here.
I had Jewish roommates, and yeah, they had a lot of laws like that.
Well, there are lots of things that came into practice that weren't in the Scriptures. We know that by the time you get to Jesus' day.
Yeah.
You know, it's a mess, and I'm sure it hasn't gotten any better since. But so here they are, and this is a part of God's foundation for them. And so they're there, and that's going to be a part of their practice. And it's bigger than we often think it is. Now, Jesus put the Sabbath in its place, because the Jews had distorted it by the time he was on the earth. But the concept here is still the same. The sad thing is that the truths that are taught by the observation of the Sabbath, a lot of our battles with the place of God, his creation and his dominion and his correctness in being the ones to say, this is how you're going to deal with my relationship with you, is challenged. And I don't mean by the world, I mean from by so many who take the name of God by being a quote church that denies so many things that are clearly said in the Scriptures. And it really damages the ability to say, our right and wrong isn't because I think it's right and wrong. It's because of what God has told us and his right to tell us. And that's really frustrating. Well, let's go on. Let me turn a page, see what I forgot to say I planned on saying. Oh, you know, I was going to make this link. We had a lot of fun. I guess fun's the right word. It was, to me, I hope to you, exciting and illuminating to go through Genesis 1, 2, and 3, talking about creation and the evidence of that and the fall of man and those things in between there. And this affirms again, once more time, that God really did his creation in 6 days, just as he told us in the book of Genesis. Okay, that takes us on to verse 12. And the command that God gives in verse 12 is to honor your father and your mother. And then he goes on to say that there is a promise that goes with this, or at least an understanding that this brings favor of God, that your days may be made long in the land the Lord gives you. There's two parts to that. One is, honor your father and your mother. Why is this important to the Jewish nation?
Respect them like you would the Lord.
Okay, all right. Respect them like you would the Lord. That's what you do. Why is it a big deal?
They're actually there to protect the family.
Okay. That's a pretty good way of saying it. At least gets at a piece of it. They're there to protect the family.
What? They brought you into the world.
Well, they brought you into the world. One of the favorite sayings I've heard many fathers say is, I brought you in the world and I can take you out. Well, I don't think that's the concept here. But we hear that on occasion, usually, I hope, always, said in jest. I've seen some pretty angry moments where it might not have been. But anyway, there is that aspect of it that your parents were involved in you even being in the world, which, by the way, is a part of God's order. What did he tell Adam and Eve? Be fruitful and multiply. I mean, he put them together, and part of that purpose was to populate this world. And it's interesting to me that when I was in grade school and somewhat in high school, everybody was concerned about a certain kind of explosion. And what was that? The population explosion. We're not going to be able to find enough food to eat. And lately I've heard two accounts of indications of a couple of countries, and I don't remember who the other one was, that they're in decline. How do we know? Their population, their new generations come up, are not as plentiful as they have been in the past, so now they're in a declining population, and that's a sign of the end of a culture when its population begins to decline. One of those was China, and I don't remember who the other one was. I don't know if I even necessarily believe all their predictions are right, but I just found it interesting that the concern in the world back in the 60s and 70s was, oh, we can't feed everybody, we better do something and have less kids and whatever else. And now it's like, well, if your nation isn't growing in numbers through births, not just through floods of people, then you're in trouble. What a change. Of course, I also lived in the 60s where the big deal was to try, they brought these computer simulators in, the big deal was to try to figure out how to get enough petroleum products to make it to the year 2000. By then, hopefully, we'd have a different form of fuel. We have more oil reserves now than we had then.
A guy by the name of Norman Borlaug increased the production of wheat by 300% by making it shorter, and he won the Nobel Prize by over tripling the supply of food.
Well, and these things happen. And I would say to you, we can give him a Nobel Prize, but that was built into the creation that God made. And so the bottom line, though, is I was headed toward, why is it important to honor the father and the mother? And that is the foundational piece, the family of culture.
Patriarchal?
Yeah, they're a patriot, and they were a patriarchal nation, but even if it's not as strongly patriarchal as it was in those days, it's still the family unit. And if the family unit becomes obliterated, your culture becomes obliterated. And it, I mean, we see it. We see it in our society. You can look at ethnic groups where the family doesn't stay together. They have the big amount of crime. They have this. They have the bigger struggles with all of the things that go along with people struggling to continue to exist, even in our country where we're very prosperous. And so God says that your days may be made long. It's a safer world to live in when the family structure is functioning properly as God intended, and that it's playing its roles in people's lives. And one of the things that's important about that, what age group is least likely to honor their father and their mother?
The teenagers.
Not only have we had teenagers, most of us, but we also were one, right? And there is a natural place in life where the tension builds because God said there's a time where you'll leave your parents, a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. There is a time to establish that new family unit, and it is necessary that those teenagers begin to move away from, well, you're my family. Now, you're still my family after I'm married, but the st- the family unit is established as a new one as you take a spouse. And so that's a challenging time. Well, the challenge only gets worse when the family unit is stretched or stressed or not intact. And so God says, you're going to live in a safer world. You're going to live longer on average if you honor your father and mother. But that's not all he says. What's the rest of that verse?
You have a long life.
Keep going. Does anybody see it yet?
Your days will be prolonged.
Keep going.
Which the Lord God gives you.
In the land that the Lord is going to give you. Why were they brought out of Egypt? They were brought out of Egypt so that God could form them into a nation and take them to the, quote, promised land. The land he had promised to Abraham, and he had also revoiced that promise through Isaac, and he revoiced it again through Jacob. Now you are the descendants of Jacob. I'm taking you out to put you in this land. And the amount of time that you be stay a nation and stay in that land will be affected by how well you honor your parents, how well you respect the family unit, how strong your family units are. And really, we have an opportunity to look back here at the commandments and see several things that have already been given to the people that are germane to, are directly linked to how their nation's going to go. The rest of the commandments will too, but these deal with the specifics God has given them about the structure that he's established. No other gods. Don't be idol worshipers. Don't make a graven image, even about me. Keep the Sabbath. That is honoring God as creator, master, ruler of the universe because he owns it. It affirms his deity, affirms his power, affirms his omniscience over that and his sovereignty over that. And by the way, keep your family unit strong by honoring parents while you're in the home and when you get out of the home. That honoring up and down through the generations will put this nation in a good place to last a long time if they don't turn against the God that created them, the God that led them out. That's how he started this, didn't he? I got you out from under and I brought you here on eagle's wings, got you out from under the Egyptians, brought you here on eagle's wings. Focus on these things because that's what's going to make your nation strong, including honoring the family unit. Questions, thoughts, comments? Let's keep going. Verse 13, you shall not murder. That word murder means slayer. It means life taker. And the world today gets a little confused about what murder is. Murder is the unjust taking of another person's life, and I don't mean that you become the decider of what's just and unjust. But what I mean is, it doesn't talk about defending yourself if you're being attacked. It doesn't talk about the role of the government in things like capital punishment. It doesn't talk about wars. There are unjust wars. There are just wars. And so these things, it doesn't mean not create any death anywhere. For that matter, people take this verse in the animal rights world and call us murderers because we butcher a pig or a cow. And so that's all a part of that. Confusion. This is murder. This is killing another person primarily out of hatred or something similar. Verse 14, this is the seventh commandment. You shall not commit adultery. That's kind of a tough one in today's world, isn't it? You don't hear people talk about adultery a whole lot. Why do you suppose we don't talk about it much?
Because the divorce rates are so high. and then everyone's remarrying.
Well, certainly there is an obedience problem. And we're just an adulterous people now, aren't we? Now, I don't mean you and me necessarily, although I think it would be tough for any of us to say that the world of temptation is the world of temptation, and even Jesus made it clear, you wander with your eyes, you've got a problem there as far as that makes you guilty in the eyes of God for your adulterous attitude. But we just live in a society that wouldn't know how to define adultery right now. Can't define marriage in any way that makes sense. So how would you define adultery in a way that makes sense? You shall not steal. Pretty obvious, isn't it? What do we mean there? And then the ninth one. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor or friend or anybody else. So that gets at being truthful. Be honest. Doesn't mean you have to be unkindly honest. We're supposed to speak the truth what? In love. And then verse 17. Don't covet. He starts out talking about your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, their neighbor's servants, your neighbor's animals, and before he's done, or anything else. Do we live in a covetous society? What is the built-in tool in our society to make us potentially covetous?
Envy.
What's that?
Envy.
Envy.
Money.
Advertising. Advertising is to make you want something. Not all advertising. Sometimes they're just telling you, oh, here's a service. They know lots of people need it. You don't know that business exists. Okay, that's one kind of advertising. But a lot of the advertising is to make you want something you would have never otherwise wanted.
There you go.
And so we have built-in covetousness. Now, we're not necessarily looking at the neighbor that has it, although you can bet there'll be pictures of people having it and loving it, right? So you don't even know that guy, but you covet what he's got. And in reality, he's probably just an actor there in the advertisement, and he really doesn't have one. So, but bottom line is, we're just built in to be that way. And for some reason, I think it's just a part of our rebellious nature toward God. I've coveted plenty of things. I've mentioned in here the day I got a chance to ride in a King Air. And I spent the next week trying to figure out how to put together $500,000 to own one. I was serious. I want one. And that would be an old, wore-out one, but it was going to be good enough. But nonetheless, we just tend to want what we don't have.
There was a movement that tried to do away with all of that under Das Kapital by Marx. You couldn't do it.
It's not going to happen. We're going to covet. And covetousness, by the way, leads to breaking the other commandments, doesn't it? You can, the obvious one there might be adultery, but thievery,
murder,
lying. You do all of those things to get what you don't have. Go read James. You lust, you're tempted, then you make plans and you don't have, so you kill and destroy to try to have. So at this point, God has voiced, in a way, the people hear through the thunder, which, by the way, remember, this was prophesied. I'm going to speak to you in front of the people so they will know that you are my spokesman, essentially, is what God tells Moses. And so these commandments have been voiced. And apparently there's a bit of a break in the action, at least in the way that Moses explains it. So let's look at verses 18 through 26. And all the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. Then they said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen. But let not God speak to us or we will die." Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you, and in order that the fear of him may remain with you so that you may not sin." So the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make other gods besides me, gods of silver or gods of gold. You shall not make for yourselves. You shall make an altar of earth for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen, in every place where I cause my name to be remembered. I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stone for me, you shall not build it of cut stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you will profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, so that your nakedness will not be exposed on it." So we have this break in the action. And there in verse 18, the people are seeing all of this. It's not just the commands of God. It's not just Moses hearing this. It's not even that it's just loud. It's overwhelming. You've got thunder. You've got lightning. You've got this trumpet blowing. You've got a mountain that's smoking. It's probably difficult for us to even try to imagine that. This is a manifestation of God and his presence that is nothing like we have ever experienced, and they hadn't either. How did they respond to that? What was their response to all of this overwhelming presence of God and all the things that were going on?
They had been afraid of what was going on.
They were scared.
Yeah.
How do we know they were scared? What actions did they take? What's that?
They backed up.
They backed up and they trembled. They're scared. And that's what's going on. And so out of that fear, what do they say to Moses?
You talk to us. You tell us what he said. We don't want to hear him again.
We don't want to hear God again. And they said, "You speak to us, we're going to listen." And it's almost like we can't listen to God. This is too much. Don't let him speak to us, or what?
We'll die.
Have they died yet? And he's been speaking to them. Why would they think they were about to die? Was this a reasonable fear?
They've been through so much. You know, they had many times they were, you know, crying for all sorts of things, and then finally God would, you know, give it to them. But then they would go back and think, oh, well, that was just another time.
They watched all the Canaanites be murdered.
Yeah. Well, they were going to watch Canaanites be murdered. Well, they watched in the battle with Amalek.
So they knew it could happen.
I mean, well, they know that God can do that, right? What's one of the problems for a person, you or me or anybody, that comes into the presence of God?
Our sin.
Our sin. And what's it cause us to do when we come into the presence of God?
Fear.
I want to look at a few examples of that. Go over to Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 26 through 28. This is one time when Ezekiel... It's when God commissions him, and so he comes into the presence of God. God's majesty has just been shown in a big way, and so, you know, here's Ezekiel. He's seen all these wheels and things going on, and creatures, and so here's his response. Ezekiel 1, 26 through 28. That's chapter 2. Now, above the expanse that was over their heads, there was something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance. I don't know what that means. And on that which resembled a throne high up was a figure with the appearance of a man. Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire around with and within it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward I saw something like fire, and there was a radiance around him. As the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard a voice speaking. Here is God presenting himself in a much less threatening way, but still a very grand way to Ezekiel. And Ezekiel gets it. This is a presence of something beyond anything I've ever seen. It's majestic. And what does Ezekiel do? Yeah. He is completely humbled by God and his presence. And because we know the attributes of God, God is, pick one,
holy.
He's also God as love and a few other things, but are you holy? Not on your best day. Not in your best minute. And just the presence of God brings that understanding, I'm not worthy to be here. Let's go over to Luke chapter 5.
In my book on chapter 26,
yes.
You didn't know what it was like.
Yeah.
It's a sapphire stone.
Yeah, okay. They just didn't translate it over or whatever. Yeah, pretty amazing stuff. Luke chapter 5. And in this case, we're looking at Peter being called. Oh, come on. Not getting there very well. Luke chapter 5. 5 through 8, this is how the Lord introduces himself to Peter. And what has happened is they've been out there fishing all night. You fishermen will appreciate this a little bit. And what did they catch?
Nothing.
What they should have expected. Nothing. That's the way fishing goes some days. And they've been doing all the smart stuff. Peter's a professional fisherman. Not like competitive fishing like we think of today, but he made his life out of getting fish out of the water. And here comes this guy up on shore and says, hey, fish on the other side of the boat. Now, sometimes that can make a difference, but here's Simon's answer. Master, we've worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets. When they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat for them to come and help them, and they came and filled both of the boats, so they began to sink. That's never expected by a fisherman, but they got a lot of fish. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, what? You're wonderful! Tell us where to fish tomorrow. No. He understands that this is a supernatural person. He might not be ready to yet voice that you are the Son of God in the way that Messiah was the Son of God. But this is what he wants from Messiah initially. Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man. Confronted with the holiness of God, that would be all of our answers one way or another. Our sinfulness is going to overwhelm us in the presence of God. Revelation 1, looking at verse 12. John has been interacting with this supernatural vision and the characters in it. But this is what happens in Revelation 1. 12 through 18. So he hears a loud voice, and in chapter 12 and following is his response. Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the middle of the lampstands I saw one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to the feet, girded across his chest with a golden sash. His head and his hair were white like wool, like snow, and his eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were burnished bronze when it has been made to glow in a furnace. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. And out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in its strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. And he placed his right hand on me, saying, "Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last, the living one, and I was dead. And behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades." How did John react to seeing the Christ, the Jesus, in his heavenly form that he had spent about 3 years walking the planet with him? The words that he used for himself in the book of John was, "I was the one Jesus loved." He never held up his own personage by name. But when he sees him in his heavenly glory, he fell down like a dead man. There are other examples in the New Testament and Old Testament of how people respond. But the response of the people at the foot of the mountain with Moses is reasonable. We can't stay in God's presence or we're going to die. They know they are not worthy to continue living as they find themselves in the presence of God. In verse 20, what does Moses then tell the people after they tell him, "You talk, we can't listen to him, please tell him to be quiet," which of course is interesting. They just asked Moses to tell this God they're deadly afraid of what to do. That's not going anywhere. But anyway, what does he say? What does Moses say to the people? Don't be afraid. God has come to test you. This is a time to see how you're going to respond to the living God in his presence as he gives you commands through me, through Moses. And it's interesting because then he goes on to say that God has a purpose in this test. And what is the purpose?
That they shouldn't sin.
Because they fear him. God wants you to fear him. What? Moses, within the space of a short few verses here, says, within one verse, don't be afraid. God's coming to test you so that the fear of him will remain. That's an interesting thing. Don't be afraid, but God wants the fear to remain. It's really two different things. Don't be afraid right now. God's not here to kill you today. But you should be afraid. You can't come into the presence of God without fear, particularly in the many multifaceted ways that he's showing that he's there. The smoke and the thunder and the quakes and the fire and the lightning, speaking of thunder, speaking out of thunder, and a trumpet blast that won't go away. Because he wants the fear of him to remain. This is to be dramatic of enough experience, or maybe traumatic enough of experience in your life. This fear should never depart from you. God's giving you a tool so that out of the fear of God, you're going to obey him. You're going to remember this mountain, and when you look at the commandments, you're going to go, "I'm not going against the commandments. I know who God is. I know his majesty. I know how fearful he is. I know how grand he is, and I'm not crossing that God. That God is absolutely in control." And out of that, then, God is trying to put you in a position where you won't, where you will not sin. Actually, with the great expanse of what God is doing here, he's treating them with loving kindness. He's not off in a distance giving them commands without also showing them, you better think about it before you cross me on this. You better recognize me as this one true God and not may have idols. There's no idol that's going to do this, right? So these manifestations of God are there to put the right fear of God in you that indeed is the beginning of wisdom. Better to recognize who God is now than discover who he is in a moment of judgment. So in verse 21, the people stand back. They're not going to get close. And Moses then approaches this thick cloud where God is. And in this, the Lord says to Moses, tell the sons of Israel this. So Moses comes up to God. Apparently the sons of Israel either aren't going to hear it or God wants it reinforced to be re-spoken or whatever. But tell them this. You yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You've seen it with your own eyes, people. That's what Moses is to tell them. And God reinforces this. You shall not make other gods, no idols, no idolatry, nothing against me, not of silver, not of gold. Don't make these for yourselves. And doesn't that then fit right in with, he's already given us a command, but here is God who is the majestic God above all in every way. And so he's going to be going to talking to them, and they're going to be told, don't do it. Why does God reinforce this command and not all of them in this short time here with Moses when Moses goes up to the cloud?
Probably because he knows they're going to make a calf.
Yeah. He knows them. He knows what to expect. So this is a second warning. Yes, he knows what's coming. He also knows that that place of God in their understanding is absolutely essential to any of the other commands working out okay and being followed. So he goes on in verse 4 and says, make an altar of earth for me, for your sacrifices, for your burnt offerings and your peace offerings. And we'll get more clarity on some of this as we go forward. There's multiple sacrifices that would be instituted with clarity through the law and through God's interaction with the people. But these obviously are already happening as well. And so you've got burnt offerings and peace offerings. What's the difference between a burnt offering and a peace offering? Well, there's a number. A burnt offering is male animals only. And there's really five choices that could be picked for a burnt offering. It was going to be a bull, a male sheep, or a male goat. Or for those that were poor, you could also use a turtle dove or a young pigeon. And the peace offerings, or I'm sorry, the burnt offerings had the purpose of being atonement for sin or in response to sin to clear the guilt of that sin. Of course, we know that the blood of bulls and goats don't take away sin. Not completely, not thoroughly, not universally, because only Jesus can do that. The peace offering, you could either have a bull or a cow, a lamb or a goat, but gender was not specific. And all that was burnt up in the peace offering were the fat and the kidneys. And the rest then was consecrated, and there were some ceremonies to go along with it. The breast and right shoulder were for the priest for sustenance. It was just how they got their food to eat. And this is as the sacrifices are fully developed. But so it wasn't really a ceremonious thing that the priest got that for food. But the rest was handled ceremoniously. I shouldn't say that, because they sometimes would do a waving of the breast and a few things in that. But the rest was to be food as a feast for those that were offering the peace offering, which might be more than one family coming together about their peace. And so the family would eat it. But also in this was a peace between God and the Israelites. And some of the practices of the peace offering was a lot like even our communion. This is peace with God. And so they would burn the portions that were to be burned and feast on that wasn't sent off for the use by the priests for their food. And it was a recognition, both a request and praise to God for his peace with them. And so they're to build these altars of earth in order to make these sacrifices. And he says, you're going to make that altar every place I cause my name to be remembered. I will come to you and I will bless you. So the idea of sacrifice, even dividing up the burnt offerings and the priest and the peace offerings, was not new. One example of this, if you go over to Genesis 8, I'm going to run out of time. Let me just tell you what you find in Genesis 8 and Genesis 12. Noah, after the flood, one of the first things he does is put together an altar and offers an offering to God. And so here is Noah doing what we're talking about here. In Genesis, we see multiple times where Abraham would stop, build an altar, name the place often, and have a burnt offering for God. As a matter of fact, there are five examples of that in the Old Testament. Jacob would also build altars, and Isaac did one, Jacob did five. And so they're out building these altars as a part of their interaction with God. So is that the beginning of offerings, Noah? No, why did Cain kill Abel? And we're in the second generation, Adam and Eve's two sons. Their squabble was over the fact that God liked Abel's offering but not Cain's. Abel's offering was the animal offering. In verse 25, he says, if you build that altar and you want to put some stones on it, you can't cut the stones. Why? Why would that profane the stones? Why would that profane the altar?
Graven image.
You're back to mankind making something. Can't you imagine how this is going to go? Look, the altar I built. Wouldn't that happen? Well, man, he made some fancy stones. How am I going to do better than that? That's exactly what would happen. No, use what stones you can find. If you can't find any, just make it out of earth. Earth was fine. But if you use tools on it, if you make this something man-made, that brings profanity on it. Oh, and by the way, no steps. Why no steps? Well, garments in that day weren't what we would call pants. And so you might get a glimpse of things that were distracting. I'll put it that way. This is a time, well, we kind of giggle about it, but that's exactly what they didn't want. They didn't want anything to distract from what's going on in making this offering to God. This is about God, not men. So first of all, don't try to build these great big high ones with steps. Now you're back to man making something again. Mine's higher than yours. And don't do things with this that would take away from the consecration the holiness, thoughts about God's holiness in this time. And so you're not going to build one with steps. The key attributes of these sacrifices are fear, reverence, and glory to God. His majesty, his power, his greatness, and you're not going to detract from that. Questions, comments? I know I kept you just a little over because I couldn't figure out how to stop. So we didn't stop. Next time, we will pick it up with chapter 21.